supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Former city prosecutor Kelly Hodge has been selected interim Philadelphia District Attorney by the Philadelphia Common Pleas Board of Judges late this afternoon. Just back from City Hall, and joining me with details is WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. Dave, tell us about Kelly Hodge.
Well, she hails from the Commonwealth of Virginia, Dave. She went to the University of Richmond Law School. She was a public defender in Richmond, then made her way to Philadelphia, where she served 8 years as a prosecutor in the Philadelphia DA's office, leaving in 2011. She was appointed by Governor Corbett to be the safe schools advocate for the Philadelphia School District. She did some other things. She's now a practicing attorney at the firm of Elliott and Greenleaf.
So she's returned from private practice.
Right.
For this interim period, what was the process by which she's emerged?
It's a little like cardinals selecting a pope, Dave. The board of judges are designated by state law as filling this vacancy. And so they had a couple of ballots. The first ballot, I will note that former District Attorney Lynn Abraham, who was well-known and controversial, fared very poorly, got only 4 votes out of 70-some-odd in attendance. The two that faced in a runoff were Judge Hodge and then John Delaney, who was a 35-year veteran of the DA's office, known particularly for his work in youth violence efforts over the years. And it took 2 ballots because there were some abstentions in the second one, but it took 3 ballots total, and Judge Hodge won it. It's interesting because she was not a former judge, as many candidates were, not a career DA, as some others were. But I think a couple of factors here. She is the first African-American woman to hold that office. This bench is about 44% minority, and I think there was a strong cadre of people who felt that mattered and that was important. I've also heard that she was supported by Larry Krasner, the successful Democratic candidate for district attorney, and that to the extent that he has any influence, maybe that helped. His wife is one of the Lisa Rao is one of the judges that made the pick.
So between now and Election Day, is she a placemark, or does she have authority to make changes that she deems fit?
Well, it's not enough time to reshape the office, to be sure. It'll be 5 months and change that she's in the office. But I think what's important right now, if you just think about what this office has been through over the last 2 years, the district attorney has been under an ethical cloud. There were rumors of an investigation, and then a year ago he admitted to failing to report $160,000 in gift. He pled to an ethics board finding earlier this year. He was indicted. He kept the office, eventually led away in handcuffs after pleading guilty to corruption. Those were embarrassing headlines, and for prosecutors to go into court every day and talk to juries about the rule of law and the importance of knowing the difference between right or wrong, it was demoralizing. And I think she is determined to bring a period of stability and ethical guidance to the office.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. In other news this evening, as Philadelphia experiences a 20% uptick in homicides so far this year, headlines have been latching onto gunfire in Center City, though the 22nd Police District, including parts of Strawberry Mansion, Brewery Town, and Yorktown, has been the epicenter of the gun violence. WHYY's Bobby Allen spent time with a longtime resident and a beat cop in the North Philly district.
48-year-old Thomas Boyd says witnessing shootings has become all too common.
I done seen a guy walk up on a guy on a bike, shoot him point blank in the head. Right here on 22nd, 23rd and Ridge. I seen a friend of mine, that street right there, shot in the chest. Over what? A couple of dollars.
The 22nd District represents just a sliver of the city of Philadelphia, some 40 square blocks north of the Art Museum. But since January, it's been the site of nearly 100 of the 680 shootings in the city. Census figures show the median household income is $16,000. A typical family in Center City makes 6 times as much. Boyd grew up in this part of North Philly. He thinks generational poverty and split family households are fueling some of the violence.
It's hard when you have no father in the house. It's hard when your mother is struggling. It's hard when you got 3 or 4 siblings and you're the oldest. And you gotta find a way to see your siblings not go hungry. What are you gonna do?
Officer Shanna Moore has been working in the 22nd District for nearly 14 years, currently assigned to community relations. She has some advice.
If you hear there's a feud going on, if you hear that somebody's coming back later, there was a fight and somebody's threatening to come back with a weapon, call 911 in advance, try to get police there.
Moore admits police can't be everywhere all the time.
We could literally pull a block away and a shooting could occur. If somebody wants to commit a shooting, it's going to happen.
The violence didn't just happen overnight, Boyd says. He says with more attention on wealthier neighborhoods like Center City, it's easy for some residents to feel hopeless.
They don't have anything really to do. So if they don't have anything to do, the next best thing for them to do is violence. I have to put it this way, that's what the devil wants.
Boyd is 48. He's a part-time cook and the father of nine. He says he's had a lot of conversations with young men in the neighborhood who've thought about using a gun. Moore, meanwhile, says when she's responding to a reported crime, some neighbors ask her why she's harassing them, when in fact, a neighbor called her to the area.
We're really not the bad guys. We're there to work together. So that mentality, I think, has to change. And if it doesn't, we're still going to do our job. We're still going to do what we have to do and protect the community the best that we can.
The police department holds monthly community meetings in the 22nd District to hear neighborhood concerns, though more often than not, few, if anyone, attends. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
In the contest to succeed New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Democrat Phil Murphy has a substantial lead in the polls and the coffers over his Republican rival Kim Guadagno. And with a scant 3.5 months remaining until voters go to the polls, there are reports that the Republican National Committee and Republican Governors Association are offering Guadagno, at best, tepid support. Let's check it out with NJ.com reporter Matt Arco. Matt, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Where are these reports coming from?
Well, a colleague and I spoke with several sources, some on the record, and some spoke to us on the basis of not giving their names, but it's coming from the Republican Governors Association and the Republican National Committee. These are two groups whose sole purpose is to support the candidacies and the efforts of Republican governors and other Republican elected officials around the country.
Now, which came first? Is it because she is trailing substantially in the polls that they really don't want to bet on that horse in the race?
So Kim Guadagno, Christie's second in command, is actually having trouble on three fronts, and it's pretty devastating. First, on the home front, because of perceived disloyalty to the governor, especially taking shots at him in the last 6 to 9 months in the primary campaign, Republican donors in the state have shied away from her. So that's problem number one. Then problem number two came up on the national level. At the Republican National Committee, Donald Trump is the head of the Republican Party. So he, in effect, controls the RNC. And when we spoke to people, what we found is that there's a combination of two things. It's one, that she's not only behind the Democratic challenger in double digits, but nearly 30 points. So her campaign is seen as a long shot. But more importantly, it sounded from folks that we spoke to that the president did not like the fact that she did not support him during the primary election or in the general election. The biggest moment then was after those Access Hollywood tapes in the general election came out. She was asked about what she thought about it, and she condemned the president. So we heard from people that, the president knows who Kim Guadagno is, and that is a sticking point. And I would just add then the Republican Governors Association, which, again, its sole purpose is to elect Republican governors, that's a little bit more strategic. I think there's a lot less emotion involved in who they decide to support and who they hold their support from so that they can support other races. That has a lot more to do with her simply just being so far behind.
And toward that end, I understand she'll be traveling out of state to Aspen, Colorado next week, where that association is meeting.
Right. So she told us yesterday that she will be going there, and that she plans to talk to Republican governors just about, general proposals about good governance. But also her main objective there is to essentially fundraise and pitch herself to folks as somebody that's worthwhile in investing with. And again, being where she is now in the polls, some people will characterize it as only July. But, the race is pretty much around the corner. So it's going to be a tough climb.
Referring back to the president, is this the same kind of warning shot that he lobbed this week at Senator Dean Heller regarding the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I don't know if I'd characterize it as the same kind of shot, but I think we've seen this repeatedly over the last few months, if not years, where once the president was elected, it kind of became clear that, look, if you didn't support me in my time of need when everybody kind of thought that I was a joke and there was still a large stock of Republican governors and other officials who were running for president, you're essentially dead to me now. I think we've seen this before. Some people in New Jersey might just think it's odd that President Donald Trump even knows of someone named Kim Guadagno, but the fact is that he's keeping a long memory.
On the assumption that the RNC and RGA have limited resources, there is only one other governor's race. It's interesting. Virginia is the only state with a one-term limit, and so it's bidding adieu to Terry McAuliffe, and it's interesting. The Democrat Ralph Northam is going up against Republican Ed Gillespie. Is that where GOP resources are going?
At this moment, they're definitely more inclined to go there, especially because if they can get a win there, where this race is now, it looks like this is certainly going to be a Democratic seat for governor. So maybe they can have a wash when the dust settles after November. But when you think about RGA resources, you also have to take in consideration that they're not just thinking the race this year. They're also thinking about next cycle as well. So that goes into consideration.
It's interesting. Of course, New Jersey is a blue state, but they have this legacy of alternating back and forth between Democratic and Republican governors. Perhaps it's just time for a Democrat.
Look, that's the line that Governor Chris Christie is using, and there is a certain amount of truth to that, right? I mean, we have had popular Republican governors in the state. The most popular governor to date is Tom Kaine Sr. He was a two-term Republican governor, and we had Kristi Whitman, a Republican governor who stepped down because she wanted to take a job in the Bush administration. You have two-term Chris Christie, who is suffering the polls for a myriad of reasons, notwithstanding Bridgegate, all the time campaigning for the Republican Governors Association and for president. But the way the polls are now, New Jersey voters are certainly looking to go Democratic.
Matt, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much.
NJ.com's Matt Arco. The federal government announced this week that it would lift the cap on temporary non-agricultural immigrant workers. The decision allows 15,000 more people to come to work in seasonal landscaping, hospitality, and entertainment under what's called an H-2B visa. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that while local employers welcome the move, it does set up a larger debate about available labor.
Carl Hempel runs Three Seasons Landscaping in Upper Darby. Earlier this year, Hempel asked the Department of Labor for 10 seasonal workers to help him put in beds, plant trees, and mulch during the busy spring season. But he got zero.
If it continues, we will close our doors. It's brutal. Not being able to have access people who are legally permitted to work.
Landscapers are the biggest users of these temporary visas, which allow recruitment from other countries in the event that U.S. workers can't be found. Last year, a part of the law authorizing these workers expired, effectively lowering the cap from previous years to 66,000 workers total. As a result, visas went fast and people like Hempel were left out. With the summer halfway over, he says he's hoping to get some more people under the expansion to help with late summer and fall, but
that 15,000 one-time relief isn't really anything but a Band-Aid.
And he'd really like to see more workers next year. Immigration attorney Art Reed says continuing to expand the program is a bad idea.
If you have a program that has high instances of abuse of workers, doesn't it make sense to sort of try to address those issues before you long-term exponentially increase the size of the programs?
H-2B workers are legally bound to one employer, and speaking up about mistreatment can cost you your job, says Reed. With these two competing viewpoints, Congress has a tall order to fill if it wants to overhaul these employment visas. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
A battle continues over an historic South Jersey home, even though it was demolished earlier this year. The Camden County Historical Society is taking the State Department of Transportation to court, claiming it committed fraud when it destroyed the Hug Harrison House in March. Details from WHYY's Peter Crimmins.
The Hugh Harrison House was built in the 18th century and in 1777 was in the middle of a Revolutionary War fight, the Battle of Gloucester. More recently, though, it was in the middle of a highway interchange reconfiguration where Interstates 76 and 295 meet. The New Jersey Department of Transportation tore it down in March. But the Camden County Historical Society says the DOT did so illegally. In a lawsuit just filed in federal district court, the Historical Society claims the house should have been protected under the National Historic Preservation Act. Society President Chris Perks obtained redacted emails among Department of Transportation officials in which they appear to be fast-tracking the demolition in order to avoid a pending court injunction that would have forced them to save the house.
One of our reasons to litigate or to sue is because now we will be able to do discovery where they're going to have to show us those emails in their entirety. And we're going to see the whole conversation that they had on that afternoon and how they made the decision to go there at dawn to tear it down.
The lawyer representing the Historical Society, Matt Litt, says the DOT was required under the National Historic Preservation Act to consult with preservation groups.
And good faith is not just the wish of the Camden County Historical Society. It's explicit in the legislation. They must act in good faith.
The demolished house cannot be rebuilt, so in its federal lawsuit, the Historical Society is asking the Department of Transportation to either construct a replica house or a Revolutionary War museum nearby. The Department of Transportation will not comment on pending litigation. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
On this day, with O.J. Simpson's parole hearing dominating the non-political news, let's note that the legacy of race relations looming large in the criminal justice system has a long history in our region. The case that shocked the country, the unquiet deaths of Vida Robert and Alexander McClay Williams, the youngest person in Pennsylvania to die in the electric chair for a crime he did not commit, is the title of Dr. Sam Lemon's book about a 1930 murder case and conviction in Delaware County. Dr. Lemon, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What piqued your initial interest in this case?
I first learned about this case when I was about 10 years old. I was living with my grandmother, and it was her father, William H. Ridley, the first African-American attorney at the Delaware County Bar, who was appointed to represent the defendant in this case about 2 weeks after the defendant made his third confession. So it was when I was living with my grandmom, she told me about this case, and it just stuck with me. And so all my life I've been fascinated about this. And as I grew up and got older, I worked in social work for many years, which gave me some important connections in county government. And then I just continued the research on my own to try and figure out what exactly happened here.
What did exactly happen? It all stems from a 1930 homicide.
That's correct. This was actually a case of lethal domestic violence being portrayed as a sex crime murder. It was not. This young man was very much like some of the young men we read about today, the Trayvon Martins and others. He was not a bad kid. He had some trouble, had some behavioral issues and some emotional issues. But when he was about 12 years old, he was adjudicated delinquent. And he was sent to the Glen Mills School for Boys, which at that time really was run like a prison. The boys were called inmates.
And so what was the exposure between the alleged perpetrator and the victim?
Glen Mills Schools has like a cottage system. So there are these very large, they're really more than cottages. They're kind of like houses, but they're set up as twins. And on the second floor are apartments for the house parents. Alexander was actually living in cottage number 5, where Vida Robert was the house mom, was the house parent. According to his court testimony, Vida's ex-husband would kick him around on the floor. And when Vida would intervene, her ex-husband would hit her. And so after this repeated abuse, Alexander asked to be moved to another cottage. So he was then moved to the adjoining cottage, cottage number 3.
There was also a very strained relationship between Vida and her husband.
Absolutely. And it's not really quite clear. They were definitely divorced in 1921 in Michigan. That's where they were originally from. Vida had actually filed for divorce on the grounds of extreme cruelty. So in 1921, for a woman to do that, I think was pretty gutsy. And it must have been a pretty severe situation.
You cited your great-grandfather as the defense attorney. He went up against what? A prosecution team of 14, I believe.
That's correct. Yes, yes. And these were heavy hitters. One obviously was a Delaware County District Attorney. There was another gentleman who was the former Philadelphia DA who was on the board of directors at the school. Several other attorneys, doctors, fingerprint experts. And then there was William Ridley, who was given $10 for expenses and 2 months to prepare a defense in a capital case.
Your great-grandfather as attorney did try to plea for his charges, life, to no avail.
Absolutely. And I think that was really the only option that he had. His only other option would have been to impugn the honesty and integrity of the entire prosecutorial team, the white judge, the white jury. I don't think that would have gotten him very far.
This was not a jury of his peers.
No, it was not.
And then what was the time period between conviction and execution?
He was convicted on January 7th, and he was executed on June 8th.
It's jaw-dropping, again, to consider that through the standards we have now, the
yes. appeals
that can take decades.
Absolutely.
That wasn't an avail?
Ridley did try an appeal the following month, but that was pretty quickly quashed. And shortly after that, Alexander was sentenced to die in the electric chair.
To what extent was there an outcry at the time to what we would now widely characterize as a miscarriage of justice?
Well, there certainly was an outcry. Interestingly enough, the African-American community was displeased with Ridley because they felt that he should have gotten this kid off. So they formed a committee to raise funds for the defense of Alexander so they could hire a white attorney that spring, hoping he might fare better, and he did not.
Were he alive, he'd be pleased to know that his case, as of recently, has been partially expunged. Explain.
I think he would be. You know, my heart goes out to that kid. I spent 30 years thinking about him and Vida Robert, and I got pretty attached to them. This was a poor, hapless soul who really had no idea why he was being electrocuted.
Dr. Sam Lemon, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
My pleasure.
The book is called The Case That Shocked the Country, The Unquiet Deaths of Vida Robert and Alexander McClay Williams, the youngest person in Pennsylvania to die in the electric chair for a crime he did not commit. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.